But here it was at 0.3% of the beer market, had seen no innovation in 30 years, less than no marketing. It was so clearly a lesser than product. And so non-alcoholic beer fell to very stigmatized, very niche populations. People have been drinking alcohol for 5,000 years, but I just think there is going to be a majority of occasions in the future where people want to socialize, want to have something delicious, but not the alcohol. We want to have a huge positive impact in the world on the way there too. I, in my head, think that non-alcoholic beer is easily going to 10 or 20% of beer, if not 50% of beer over time, as increasingly influential people continue to talk about it publicly and destigmatize it. But I think this is just the very emergence of a long-term emerging category. What I think is different about non-alcoholic beer than all the other beverage alcohol trends is every other beverage alcohol trend has been like a one-for-one substitution of the same occasion. What we're doing is like totally reinventing and opening up occasions. So it's more occasions for existing drinkers.
When you were figuring out how the heck do I market this thing, what did you do?
At that stage of the company, I was just thinking like myself, like where would I want to encounter this product and discover it? I knew people would have to try it to believe it, that it was good, and imagine when it would fit into their life. And I really chose athletic events, not because of the name of the company, but because.
Welcome to The Peel, where we explore the world's greatest startup stories. I'm your host, Turner Novak, founder of Banana Capital, the venture capital firm that also created a new market. Keep listening for my conversation with Bill Schufelt, founder and CEO of Athletic Brewing. Athletic pioneered the alcohol-free adult beverage category, taking it from 0.2% of the total beer market to Athletic being the number one selling beer in Whole Foods within 5 years. Bill grew the business to $90 million in revenue within 5 years after launching, but he specifically emphasizes how slow they actually went to get there. We talk through the history of non-alcoholic beer and all the health benefits, writing a 96-page white paper on the market while still working in his prior hedge fund job, Bill's process for thinking through creating a new category or market, the struggles of raising the very first angel round, how he marketed the product in the early days, Athletic's unique omnichannel strategy that enabled them to iterate very fast, and the story behind getting into Whole Foods in only 2 weeks. Bill never thought he'd be an entrepreneur, and Athletic Brewing is a testament to playing the long game and a story of following your passions and being the change you want to see in the world. A quick shout out to my friend Joe Pompliano for help suggesting great questions, who actually quit his full-time job to go all in on his own business after signing an early deal with Athletic. I think you'll learn a lot. Let's jump in after a quick word from Atio. There's a world where your CRM is powerful, easily configured, and deeply intuitive. Atio makes it a reality. Atio is a CRM built specifically for today's modern company. It's flexible, easily configures to your unique data structures, and works for any go-to-market motion, from self-serve to sales-led. It automatically enriches your contacts, syncs your emails and calendar, lets you create powerful reports, and quickly build Zapier-style automations. The next era of companies deserves more than a one-size-fits-all CRM with an outdated user experience. Someone recently described Atio to me as the linear of CRM, which, if you're in the know, that is pretty high praise. Join 11 Labs, Replicate, Modal, and more. Try Atio instantly at atio.com. That's A-T-T-I-O.com. Or if you want to support the show, tap the link in the show notes and scale your company to the next level. Thank you, Atio. Now let's talk to Bill Schufelt at Athletic Brewing. Bill, how's it going? Welcome to the show.
Awesome. Turner, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Yeah, so I'm excited for you. I read a stat recently that as of, I don't know exact date, but you were the number one beer sold in Whole Foods just by volume. That's pretty incredible.
Yeah, the Whole Foods data set is definitely some of our best data. When I was starting Athletic, a lot of where we could go was just narrative, and we didn't have any real world examples to hang our hat on. But I had my experience, and I was like, this is going to be huge. There's a sea change going on, and one day it could look like this. But it was always pointing at other things, saying it could be that. And now we have real data. We have national retailers where non-alcoholic beers, over 10% of all beer sold in them, where it was like 0.3% of beer when we started. And in one of the most leading edge grocery stores nationally, Athletic's the number one adult beverage overall. So that has been like the first not the first, but like a real, real proof point that it is happening and it's going to keep happening.
Yeah, because I remember even growing up, like in college, you know, you're drinking Bud Light or whatever, and you kind of wonder, do I need to be drinking this? Like, there's obviously some benefits to drinking alcohol, but there's obviously like a lot of downsides too. And so it's so fascinating that it was just kind of not a market, really, non-alcoholic beer. How did you come up, or how did you come across the opportunity originally? Like, was there a thing where you kind of had this light bulb went off as like, wow, you can drink non-alcoholic beer?
Yeah. It had to happen to me personally. And I apologize in advance. Like, the scroll past rate on this episode, I hope, isn't too high in your episode list because it has non-alcoholic beer in it. But like, there are such misconceptions about non-alcoholic beer. And I admit I was part of that. Like, I only ever spoke about non-alcoholic beer if I was making fun of it, until I was a drinker of non-alcoholic beer and like really wanted it and needed it. And I think the hard part is non-alcoholic beer was really born out of the Prohibition era. So like, it was when alcohol was taken away, which was like this fun thing. America was just into the roaring 20s. And like, I don't know when exactly Prohibition went into effect, but essentially fun was taken away, all these great options off the table, and this generic near beer entry emerged. And it was so clearly a lesser than product, and it was marketed as such. And it just carried these enormous stigmas forward, like 80 years. And there was really no marketing effort or product innovation effort to try to change those deeply ingrained stigmas in society. And so non-alcoholic beer fell to very stigmatized, very niche populations. It was assumed that non-alcoholic beer is for people with medical conditions, religious preferences, or people in recovery, and really thought of this market that was like 1% of the population, 1% of their life, like niche of niche, where really it's almost the exact opposite. Like, if you really think about non-alcoholic beer, the occasion base, when it could be consumed, it's not 1% of 1%. It's actually almost everyone is not drinking 99% of the time. And if it tastes well, if it's marketing great and people are excited about it, this could be the best part of the day of like a majority of the population. But here it was at 0.3% of the beer market, had seen no innovation in 30 years, less than no marketing. So I was, call it mid-2010s, like walking around in grocery stores. And so I had stopped drinking for kind of just like personal lifestyle reasons. And I can go more into that. But, you know, if you look around the grocery store at that time, every category had totally innovated. Like, if you walked into Whole Foods, it's like local this, organic this, like there were incredible sourcing on everything in the whole store. Nothing looked like it did in the 1980s, except this one corner and these like two dusty offerings in the corner. And it was like, why isn't that shelf changing? There's 10,000 breweries in the country, and why is no one thinking about this?
It's kind of an oxymoron, non-alcoholic beer. Like, it sounds like that can't exist almost.
Yeah, the name of the category itself might as well say like not fun, not good, like non-alcoholic is like, it's just like no, no, no. And here I was, you know, I think just like so many people fashion themselves, like I'm not that special a person. I thought of myself as a very average, modern, busy adult. I was working at a large hedge fund. I like to do my workouts in the morning. So like wake up at 5 a.m., work out, go to work. I was like graded on my outputs at work in a very intensive trading hedge fund shop. And then after work, I wanted to do work dinners, social stuff, dinner with my wife. And like, but that was all alcohol occasions, most days of the week, most days of the weekend. And alcohol was such a performance ceiling on my whole life. And like work was just following me around in my phone. At those work dinners, I wanted to be like totally coherent and like taking notes and stuff. And, you know, at the end of it, I was like, maybe I'll stop drinking for a month. In that, I was training for a long distance running event. And I was like, I'm going to stop drinking for a month. And like, I'd been blowing myself up somewhat too regularly during that also.
Blowing yourself up, like drinking too much, you mean? Or?
Yeah, like occasionally drinking too much. And I was like, man, this is just so unproductive to everything. And I stopped drinking for a month and I slept incredible. I felt great working out. was unintentionally losing weight. I was super focused at work. I had no off days. And it was just like this like positive cycle that I had entered into. And I realized alcohol was this big limiting factor on my lifestyle. And it didn't take long at all for me to realize that. But I was in all those social situations, all those work situations, everything. And I just had such an authentic need for better products there. Like I was either on the kids menu or had these very inferior older products. And it was just a product that really needed innovation.
Is it like less profitable to sell non-alcoholic beer? Like, do you think there was some kind of incentive thing, the reason that people didn't really ever invest in it? Like, have you ever figured that out?
Well, I think there's a bit of an innovator's dilemma too. So if people who make 99.5% of their money on selling alcohol talk positively about non-alcoholic beer, there's like, ooh, do we really want to like steer people in that way? They may realize they don't need the money train as much. Like, so I think there's a bit of innovator's dilemma, and there's a lot of friction to getting going. I mean, absolutely nobody in the industry wanted to work on this. Nobody wanted to talk about it. It was really hard to attract resources. I went through some really big valleys of lack of awareness, and it took me forever to find our, you know, technical co-founder. Like, I came in as an outsider, and our other co-founder, John, is an incredibly talented brewmaster who both of us have grown a lot with the business as it's scaled. But I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people before I got to John, and it was all no's, all rejection, contract manufacturer. And so we built it all ourselves. And so I think there was a huge amount of friction and disbelief to getting going. But obviously now there's hundreds of entrants who've come into the category since Athletic started.
Yeah. And when you first started it, what do you think the opportunity was to build a big non-alcoholic beer business? Like, was there a reason that it didn't have to just exist inside of a different kind of incumbent? Was it just that nobody cared and it was just like a new product or new market?
Yeah, I think for it to really, like a true innovation to happen, it was almost too much of a bureaucratic risk to happen within a big company in a way, for someone to really make a big bet on and put their name on. I do really respect and want to shout out, like, Heineken especially did a really nice job with their Heineken 00 and launching that from within the company. And since then, a number of the big brewers have launched products in the category, which is awesome. It's a rising tide environment and very positive sum. But I think it had to come from the outside. It was such a hard road to slog, both on product and marketing, that I think it's natural that there's a specialist in the category.
And then do you have to do a different type of process to brew it? So it's almost like different, like you need to invest in completely new machinery, maybe a new brewer, like entire brewery or entire facility. Is that true?
So there are some pretty big technical and investment moats. So like there's 10,000 breweries and 10,000 wineries in the country. And relative to the average brewer making like a new product, say a hard seltzer or something, requires no new equipment, can just plug and play and go.
Really? So you make hard seltzer with the like beer lines or?
I was comparing it to other types of innovation. So if your average craft brewer was to like make a line extension of some new beer or some new hard seltzer, it's kind of plug and play and go. For non-alcoholic beer, one of our first principles moments was kind of not using all the existing technology that had been used to make non-alcoholic beer, come up with a new process ourselves from the ground up that wasn't as highly processed, and go about making the product in a totally different way. And once we realized we actually had this very valuable proprietary secret on how to make it differently, that was a big part of our decision to stand up our own facilities. It is somewhat different equipment, a lot more actually on the food safety and quality side, which is kind of out of reach of most brewers in terms of capital expenditures, but really to protect it as a trade secret also and control the quality ourselves too. We knew coming into this category that was so stigmatized on quality, we wanted to have perfect beer every time. Otherwise, we were dumping it and we didn't want to rely on a contract manufacturer for that. So that was definitely part of it.
So when you say compromising on quality, are you saying just generally, we'll say 10 years ago, pre-Athletic Brewing existing, the beer didn't taste that good or was very low taste? Or
yeah, well, By TTB standards, we're not allowed to disparage other brands. So I will say the market itself was bleak enough that I didn't have an entrepreneurial bone in my body. And it was so bleak that I wanted to go out and reinvent the category. And I saw an opportunity to make far better products. I did see a big economic opportunity, but I was already in a great economic opportunity in my hedge fund job. Like, the risk reward of leaving that job for better economics was very poor. You know how bad the percentages are of companies hitting escape velocity. But a big part of it was like the personal impact too. You know, there's something beautiful about working a job and getting a paycheck. But there is part of life that I think is so, the fulfillment and the impact is so important too. And I'd never really had that. And so I kind of saw in my own life how positive an impact reducing my alcohol intake had on, you know, my sleep, my health, my performance at work, my personal relationships, my workouts, my fitness, and even things like over time, like my intellectual curiosity. I hadn't really been much of a reader for like 12 or 15 years since like high school. And all of a sudden at age 30, when I stopped drinking, I was like mowing through books at night. It was like my intellectual light bulb had been turned back on. And I was all of a sudden like watching YouTubes on topics I was interested in. I was just like picking up books on all different topics for the first time. And so it was like this really positive thing in my life. And I actually had a couple friends, like just like on a lead by example, like started to drink less or stop drinking entirely, asked me how my journey was. Did anyone care? Did your coworkers treat you different? And when I saw the impact on some of their lives, that was really meaningful to me on like a one-on-one basis. And I saw the chance with Athletic Brewing to potentially do that at scale. Like, there hadn't existed these moderation off-ramps. It was either you were drinking or you were not drinking and you were not participating before. And that was a pretty stigmatized choice. And like, if you look around at the stats too, like alcohol has a lot of stats attached to it in society, like well past the 15 million documented alcoholics in the country. One of every five deaths below the age of 50 is attributed to alcohol. 5% of all cancer, 70% of incarcerated people are under the influence. And so there's like just like crazy stats on the impact of alcohol in the world. And I was like, I never wanted to stand on a soapbox and be like prohibitionist whatsoever. Like, the world's a stressful place and people can relax in whatever way makes sense for them. However, if we could destigmatize other options that were more moderate, probably have an enormous positive impact on tens of millions of people over time. And that's been one of the most exciting things playing out that I've seen in Athletic Brewing.
Yeah. And technically, I actually have one of the cans in front of me here. I'm going to open it in a second. There's technically a very, very small amount of alcohol, right? It says in the can 0.5% alcohol. So how would that kind of compare to just a traditional, just beer, like alcoholic beer?
So that's kind of just a labeling thing. And I know because it's called out on the label that like it brings attention to it, but really like an enormous percent of the food in grocery stores has alcohol. So basically any drink you have with flavor probably has alcohol. All your favorite colas have trace alcohol, like fruit juices, really anything with flavored, like flavored sparkling waters have trace alcohol, pasta, bread, anything with carbs, basically. So bread can be up to 2% ABV. So like, yeah, it's a big misconception that like everything is 0.0 that's not alcoholic beer. It's like actually pretty much everything in the grocery store has 0 to 0.5% alcohol. It's just labeled very clearly because this is non-alcoholic beer. So
this is almost, there's the same amount of alcohol in an Athletic Brewing beer as you'd get in like a Pepsi or a Coke or soft drink potentially.
It could be more or less depending on the beer and depending on the brand, but it's in the same non-alcoholic federal standard of all those products. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, cool. I'm going to open this one up right now because I haven't tried this flavor yet. So I don't know how loud this will be on the mic for everybody. Cheers. And this is your IPA, right?
Yeah. So that's our Run Wild IPA. That was one of two brands we launched with. It's still our most popular beer. It's really like the most highly awarded non-alcoholic beer on the planet. It's meant to be like a traditional but very approachable West Coast IPA. It's got like a Vienna malt backbone that's pretty hearty, and like a few different hops make up the hop bill.
Okay. Yeah. It literally tastes like an IPA that you'd get from any craft brewer. Like it, very comparable.
Oh, thank you. It's definitely the goal is, yeah, they've won. Most of our flagship beers have won awards versus full strength alcohol beers at different competitions and stuff. Yeah, the goal is to, I said the word without compromise earlier, but that's like one of our main slogans. It's meant to be like the same flavor, the same experience as alcoholic beer. And that lets, you know, someone have it as a dinner on like a dinner pairing on Tuesday, or like, you know, you can drink non-alcoholic beer at any time and have a great culinary experience and then get back to whatever you're doing too and not feel like you'd cross this alcohol line in the sand for the day.
Yeah. And I think when I first reached out to you, I mentioned my father-in-law has been drinking it for a couple of years. And when he, I remember the first time I noticed it, I was like, non-alcoholic beer? What? That's so crazy. But yeah, he's like, yeah, just, I like beer, but he, for some health reasons, he can't really drink it anymore. He has to be pretty, pretty careful. And yeah, just have a couple athletic brews and he's still good. There's no real impact from it. So it's super impressive. It's really cool.
Awesome. Yeah. That's what it's all about is like you just said with your father-in-law, but like anyone not drinking for any reason at all. And like they may drink alcohol at other days of the week. Like 80% of our customers do still drink alcohol at other times. It's just, they like a good tasting beer with flexibility in other times.
Yeah. It's almost like you hit this, you mentioned a bunch of reasons of why you may not want to drink alcohol, but there's still this kind of social signaling reasons that like, hey, you might want a can of beer in your hand just to fit in or for social purposes. And you've also kind of solved that too, where if you look at the can, it just looks like a can of beer. There's no like, oh, that person's drinking a non-alcoholic beer, or they're not cool, or you know, it's a can of water or something, or a bottle of water or a glass. Like it fits right in. So
yeah, there is, even in like a group of five people, there's like so much stigma around choosing not to drink that it like it does make everyone uncomfortable because it's so ingrained in society. And we really just want to give people options that they can be like proud of and comfortable with. And like one of the big things for me was realizing I just love to be in bars, and like it was more about getting to the place and seeing the people and being with the people I wanted to be with than it ever was about the alcohol and the drinks itself. But it took me a long time to realize that it actually wasn't about the alcohol that I was doing anything on weekend nights.
So then what was the moment that you started the company? Like, I know that you kind of have a story of like that specific time or that period. Can you just talk us through that?
Yeah. And as I said, I didn't have an entrepreneurial bone in my body. I thought I had just stopped drinking and I was like on with my finance career. And so about a year and a half after I stopped drinking, me and my wife were walking to dinner and I was just complaining about like, I know there's going to be like, we're walking to a great dinner. I was really excited about, but I was saying, I bet there's going to be like a sugary soda at most, like a mocktail that they take no pride in. And I was basically like, why can't someone just fix this? It's so annoying. Like I was basically saying it's going to ruin the whole dinner just because there aren't any good non-alcoholic drink options. And I was like, I'd pay anything for a good non-alcoholic beer to be on that menu. And my wife like hit me so hard in the shoulder. She was like, and she never tells me I have good ideas or anything. Like she's definitely like my biggest critic and advisor. And like, she was like, that is a good idea. You should do it. And I was like, what are you talking about? Like, it hadn't even crossed my mind that this was an idea. And she was actually getting her MBA at the time. So she was probably in a really receptive place to hear that also and to help me in business planning. But it was just this incredible snowball feeling of passion and intellectual curiosity and research. And you know, that feeling when you just get absolutely lost in a project. And that happened for like 2 years. I was just like having so much fun working on this project and researching and calling people and like reading brewing textbooks. But eventually that got to a point where I thought I was 2 years in and I honestly didn't know if I was ever going to do anything with it. I had actually told a colleague about it for the first time. I had told no one I was working with that I was working on this the whole 2 years until a couple of weeks before I quit. And I told a colleague finally, and I said, but there's like 10% chance I ever do anything with it. And then fast forward a couple weeks, it's like the last couple days of the year, like December 27th, and me and my wife go out to dinner. And I didn't realize, but she was basically like, wanted to go out to dinner to sit me down and talk about this. And she's like, I want you to walk in on the second of the year and quit your job. And she was like, we can figure out the budgets, we can make this work. But like, this is such a passion. And I don't want to be talking about this in 20 years as non-alcoholic beer becomes an enormous thing. You had the idea, you didn't do anything with it. You had this business plan. She's like, I don't want to know you if we're talking about this as we get old and gray and you don't do anything with it. And I was like, kind of like blown away and thought about it for 2 days and walked in and quit my job. But it was like, yeah, my wife was super involved in those two very pivotal moments and has since, like, we talk about it every day, obviously. But yeah, and then I was all of a sudden out the door, hadn't intended to quit my job even a week before. And I was just kind of off and running. It was very much a burn the boats moment. I was an accidental entrepreneur. I've had one idea ever, and I've just been so excited about it.
So were you almost approaching this maybe from an industry research standpoint? Like, if you found an investment opportunity at the fund you were at, maybe you would be able to take advantage of it. Was that maybe like the initial stages of research, or?
For some reason, not. I guess I had scoured the internet and Europe pretty hard for non-alcoholic beer. So I was pretty confident nothing that great existed. And like, there wasn't anyone at least like talking publicly that they were working on it or anything. So I'd kind of hit a dead end in many ways. I'd never thought about it that way, but I don't think I was looking to invest in something. I think I was just ready to build it and make it happen.
And you, I've heard you mention this before. You had a 96-page business plan. I mean, that's intense. What was in those 96 pages?
It was a real like white paper on what non-alcoholic beer in America could be, why it doesn't exist, why it could exist, analogs in the real world. You know, everywhere else in the world, non-alcoholic beer was already essentially 5% of the global beer market. And in a lot of European countries, it was upwards of 5, 8, 10% at the time already. So there are real places around the world, even where alcohol is a big part of customs and social norms, that non-alcoholic beer was going to be a big thing and some green shoots that way. But I have every respect for serial entrepreneurs and people who can identify something and be like, that's probably going to be big. And they develop it, they spin it up and they sell it and they're on to the next thing. I had such a deep feeling in myself, like just that I am an average modern consumer and I need this so badly that there've got to be 100 million other people just like me looking for this. And so kind of went out there to fix it with, like, of course I ran surveys and stuff and I had a lot of survey data in that business plan, but like, I just had such confidence that this was going to be big. I will say it did really help that like, at the moment, as I was in business planning, there was like the biggest craft brewery buying spree ever going on. Anheuser-Busch had just bought like 10 craft breweries at mostly undisclosed sums. But there were two enormous headline transactions. Lagunitas and Ballast Point both got bought for $1 billion right around that time. I think one of those happened before I quit my job, one happened after. But I had these two great exit stories, even though I was not like planning on building for an exit necessarily, but it at least made it somewhat easier or more real world to raise money with. There's actually industry activity happening. So
then what came first? Did you raise money or did you find your co-founder?
So I was dialing in the business plan for the next 6 months after I quit my job and immediately started networking. So I was like going to brewing conferences with like 10,000 people, like really out of my comfort zone, just trying to talk to people. And
did you tell them what you were doing, or were you pretty quiet about that?
I tried to. And, you know, in business planning, I was like so secretive of the idea. And then immediately once I crossed the threshold to talking about it, I was like open to talking about it with anyone. And I'm glad I did that because I got a lot of really good feedback along the way. And it's something that took me a while to realize is that like an idea is an idea. An idea is like 0.1%. The chance someone takes your idea and goes and works relentlessly on it and spins it up and is successful as a competitor is like so, so low. Even at the biggest competitors or like multinationals, like people don't just grab onto ideas and incubate them. It's like there's like literally not a process for it. So I generally find like sharing ideas and talking about it is like a very positive feedback loop. What was not a very positive feedback loop was talking to people about my idea, because it was just like straight rejection across the board. And I am like very nice people. The brewing world is full of like extremely nice people. And
even they were dismissive or.
Yeah. In like the nicest way possible, they'd be like, man, we see thousands of people at our tap room every year and not one of them has ever asked for non-alcoholic beer. Or like, I'm like, oh, have you tried offering it? Or do you like do a survey? Do you say like, would you have had a non-alcoholic beer today if we had one, you know? And they're like, so I started putting up job ads on message boards and stuff. And yeah, literally talked to hundreds of people before I got to our co-founder. And by the time he responded, non-alcoholic beer was not in the job ad. And he applied and he had all sorts of awards. He had won like a bunch of like the highest to win like IPA craft brewing awards at very peak industry times too. So like super competitive awards he had won or medaled in. So I knew I was talking to an extremely talented person, probably the most talented of everyone I had talked to. And I basically started the conversation with like, please don't hang up. Like, I know you're going to say no, but please don't tell me no till Monday. I was like, if you promise me you'll just like listen for 5 minutes and say no on Monday, that would be like really make my weekend. And he was like, okay.
He's probably like, what is this guy about to tell me? Like, what is he going to say?
And then he like gave me all the time in the world. And I was just like rambling about my non-alcoholic beer manifesto. And I think he was a young parent at the time. He had a one-year-old and a five-year-old. He'd grown up in the food service industry. His dad had been a pioneer on like farm-to-table restaurants. And he like really understood the food industry, but also like the alcohol side of that a little bit. So he's like, well, thank you. This was really interesting. Like, I'll think about it over the weekend. And apparently he talked to his family and like thought about it a lot. And the like innovation challenge of it, coupled with like the potential for positive impact. And he hit me back on email and he was like, I was immediately going to hang up, but you convinced me to stay on a few minutes. And he's like, then I was 100% going to say no, dot, 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 dot. And I think it's genius. He's like, I see it. He's like, the world needs it. This will be such a fun challenge. And me and him just like spun off and talking about it and emailing about it. And then I flew down probably within a few days to see him in New Mexico. Oh yeah. By the way, he was almost perfectly across the country. The one person interested in this.
Yeah. You were still in, I don't know if you mentioned.
Connecticut.
Yeah, you were in Connecticut. Okay.
Yeah. So I'd basically put my life savings into securing a warehouse and some very small brewing equipment.
This was pre-meeting John?
Right about the same time. Yeah. And so I actually didn't commit to the warehouse till like 3 months after I met John. Yeah. So I convinced him to move across the family with his one-year-old, five-year-old and his wife. And yeah, basically we started homebrewing in an empty warehouse, just like two grown men who didn't know each other. But it gave us a really good chance to set the company up for the long term. Things that I didn't expect to be so important because they'd never been important in prior organizations I worked at, like the employee handbook, company values, like setting the team and the foundation of the company up for the long term with like the impact we wanted Athletic Brewing to have in the world, which was in my business plan and all my planning materials. But really like concretely setting that up and then communicating to everyone who joined our company along the way went way farther than I ever would have thought. Like I would have thought I'd write the employee handbook once and put it in a filing cabinet. And like, if we ever ran into trouble, I'd be like, well, you read it. But like, it actually is something like I sit down and talk to with every single person who joins our company still to this day. And it's been like really like a North Star. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah. I mean, I think of all those corporate employee handbooks that they give out on the first day and then you put them in your desk and then you never look at it again.
Yeah, I think the difference is like me and John wrote it, we iterated on it and like we were like, okay, this is a good version of this handbook. And then I think on day like early in their employment with Athletic, people sit down with me and they're like, wow, he's really excited about this handbook. It must be important.
Yeah. And you did this while you were brewing the first, like testing the first recipes, basically, right?
Yeah. So to set the stage a little bit, John moves across the country. I'd bought these stainless steel tanks and fermenters that were about like as tall as me. There was a 3.5 barrel system. And John goes, those are way too big. And he brought in Gatorade jugs the next day from his house and like literally a gas stove to like cook them on. And And so we had this string of Gatorade jugs stacked three high in a row in like a stair formation almost. And we did hundreds of trials. So we'd probably do like three a day. You know, we'd change like, it was like purely scientific method. It was like, we're going to change the temperature in this tank 1 degree today. And we're going to do this thing different the next day, this thing different the next day, and see how it came out. And at any given time, we had this like, we called it a fermentation cart, but we had like 20 or 30 experiments going on at once. And they're like bubbling in these carboys. And we'd monitor them, we'd taste them, and we'd like take notes and we'd adjust like back in the process. And it was a really fun time and super small scale. And I'd say around like 4 or 5 months into it, the beer actually started to taste pretty good. So at that time, we moved the homebrew setup to his parents' garage, actually, which, yeah, another embarrassing thing for two grown men. But like, they just had like a little more space there. And we started to do construction on the warehouse. Oh, I didn't realize the homebrew setup is on the wall behind me there.
Oh, nice. Okay. So this was the one in your warehouse or in his parents' garage?
Yeah. So that's Stratford, Connecticut. It was our first brewery. It was about 8,000 square feet.
So when you say Gatorade jugs, it's like the football sideline Gatorade.
Exactly.
I thought you meant Gatorade, like a little, like a big thing you drink out of, but okay.
Yep. And so, yeah, we went from that. The beer started to taste good. Then we started hand bottling it. I started taking it around to retailers. I built a list of like 300 interested retail clients, took it to a distributor. And then that way, when we finished construction, we had a distributor ready to go. We had a retail list ready to go. I had a full list of summer sampling events ready to go. And we're kind of like a coiled spring ready to hit the market a little bit. A market that didn't want our products at all. But
well, so the retailers didn't want it, or the consumers didn't know that they wanted it, or?
Kind of exactly that. It's like, you know, there's such overused quotes about like, Henry Ford saying like, if he asked customers what they want, he'd say a faster horse or something like that. It was like one of those situations where the distributors didn't want it, the retailers didn't want it, and the customers didn't know they wanted it. So there was like no dialogue around the category. I had to find the customers, find the retailers to convince the distributors. But then once it was on the retail shelves, I marketed and sampled like crazy to make sure people were coming to the stores to clear it out. And it actually was, it was like the biggest oxymoron or ironic shift where we literally could not have a discussion or get someone to care whatsoever in 2018. And then coming around to the next summer on the market for 2019, we'd been sampling like crazy and like opening retailers. All of a sudden in summer 2019, this enormous brewery we had built that we thought was going to last us for 5 years potentially, we outgrew it in like 10 months. So it was just like all of a sudden, like every week, the shelves were getting cleared out. We could not keep up. We had to hire more people. We raised more money. And we doubled the size of the brewery in very short order in like June 2019. And we're like, whew, we're going to be good for another few years now. And like we outgrew it in like 2 months.
Holy cow. Wow.
And so it was, we kind of knew we were in like scaling trouble there, because it's not like a piece of software where it can basically like scale infinitely if you get the cloud space. It's, we had to actually like build the manufacturing, and like manufacturing is like a, if you are absolutely flying, manufacturing building is like 18 months. And so, yeah, we started hunting for distressed facilities at that point. So we're,
you said distressed?
Yeah, I don't mean to use that term so lightly. It's just like underutilized breweries essentially that we could go out and potentially purchase.
Okay. So get a good deal, basically.
Yeah. Cause we were pretty undercapitalized from in all directions. Like, so working undercapitalized on working capital, undercapitalized on being able to acquire a nice brewery or surely build one. And so, yeah, we went out there and started kind of knocking on doors and seeing, is there any underutilized capacity out there? Where would it make sense? I guess a big part of what I left out before too, and like why we hyperscaled so fast, is we entered a category that had been nothing but lagers. It was like, boom, one kind of beer. That was all the category was. If you were drinking non-alcoholic beer, you got a lager. Come Athletic Brewing, we made a whole range of beers. So we launched with an IPA and a golden ale, but we also launched digitally native on D2C. So most alcohol breweries, when they launch locally, and then you open beer distributors, but it's extremely fragmented and takes a long time to scale out your web. Even as recently as 2018, when we launched, there was almost no CPG going on the internet, definitely not in beverage. Like Hint Water had launched online, and they were like a real pioneer on D2C. And I kind of read about that story in Kara Golden, and I was like, Athletic could definitely sell online. Why not? And so we launched online, and I was packaging the packages. I was like, you know, if we sell five a day, whatever, it's great. And at first it was like five a day, that was 10, that was 25, that was like 50 a weekend. And before I knew it, it was like over 100 orders a day coming in on our e-commerce, because where the category had been one style, we were all of a sudden offering, we launched like 15 beers that first year, and we averaged like 50 new beers a year since then. So it was like more variety than the category had ever known. And I would, like, by no means am I like a TikTok genius or anything. Our social media was just very authentically our company story. And at 12 o'clock every day, I would just like walk into the back and be like, this is what we're doing today. Or like, this is the race I'm at. This is where I'm sampling, or this is where I am in the world. It was like in a very authentic like feed of what's going on at Athletic Brewing. And so every Monday at 5 o'clock, we'd release our new flavor of the week. And I'd post about it at like lunchtime, what it is. And all of a sudden, people became very accustomed to being at their computers at 5 o'clock and buying the week's release. And we started selling out of these releases in like 30 seconds.
Wow. Okay.
Like, I think a lot of people have a concept of what like a craft brewery like hype release is. And like people go wait in line for like a beer release for like a big one. And that line can be hours long. What was different about us is we were launching just online, like a Ticketmaster concert or something. And me and John were absolutely shocked that, like, you know, these 1,000 orders would go through in like 30 seconds. And then I'd get phone calls. I was customer experience. I was everything. And so like my phone would just absolutely blow up for like 6 hours after that. And I'd have to like apologize to people, tell them when the next one is, what's coming next week, things like that. And I basically, anytime we released a beer, I'd spend till like 2 a.m. on my phone talking to customers after that. But that was great in many ways too, because like the iteration and the feedback we got through the whole, I was doing our social media and our customer experience for at least the first 18 months of the brand. And like that customer touch point was so valuable. Everyone has their own journey, and like ours surely hasn't been perfect, but I am thankful that like I wasn't over-resourced and I didn't launch with like a big team, or especially a team of senior people, because I think a lot of times companies almost build too much and they never get that feedback around launch time from their customers. And I had to face our customers every single day on social media, in phone calls, in emails. I was doing like 75 sampling events a summer, like giving out beers too. So like I had constant contact with our community. I think that was very formative also.
Yeah. And so I think you started the company in 17, launched in 18, and then 2019, you did about $2.5 million in revenue, roughly. I think that was the numbers that I saw.
Yep. Yeah. And so then we had a like LOI on a facility all the way across the country, because we were selling a lot of beer in California and just generally the West Coast online. And so in March 2020, we bought a facility. Like me and John were in Connecticut, and we bought a facility in San Diego, and COVID hit.
Yeah. And anytime someone says March 2020, I always know something is about to go down.
Yeah. So we made like the biggest financial investment of our company's life. Thank goodness we had just closed our Series B. And so we were well capitalized, and we had some great teammates heading that direction. And we actually like hyperscaled like crazy during COVID. We finished 2019 with 26 teammates, and we finished 2020 with about 120. Most of those were on the West Coast. And I would say an extremely high percentage of those teammates are still with us 4 years in here. Yeah, I moved to the West Coast myself to be closer to that newly gelling team out there. Yeah, so we bought a 40,000 barrel brewery, scaled that up to about 160,000 barrels. It's like 80,000 square feet was that facility, so about 10 times the footprint and 15 times the output of our initial facility.
And you did, I think in 2020, you did about $15 million in revenue is what I saw.
Yeah, somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah. And then you had 61% market share of the non-alcoholic beer industry in the U.S. or something like that. I mean, that's a pretty big percentage.
Yeah, it's kind of held pretty close to that. I think we're still like 55% share of the craft non-alcoholic beer market. When we launched, there were about 8 to 10 maybe non-alcoholic beers in the country. There's now 150 brands and about 500 beers in the market. And Athletic's about a 55% share of the craft non-alcoholic side. Yeah, it's been fun since then. And in 2020, we were finally able to open more states of distribution. So we probably opened about 20 states of distribution that year. And then we also started to look at where we could scale up our East Coast manufacturing footprint as well. And so in 2021, we lost a lot of facilities to bigger, like warehouse type companies over that time period. But we finally found a great one on the East Coast in August of 2021 and scaled that up and opened it in June of 22. And so the new brewery in Connecticut that I'm in right now is about 50 times the capacity of our original brewery and about a little over 15 times the footprint.
One thing I really wanted to hit on was fundraising. You touched on it a little bit, but I know you had a lot of conversations and it was a long grind. from what it sounds like. What was that very first round that you raised? Like, this was back, was it before you launched? And was it just after you had kind of brought John on as a co-founder?
Yeah. So most of our angel investors, as unbelievable it sounds, I can't believe I was actually like raising the money at this point. It almost seems asynchronous to company progress, but I raised most of our angel round without anyone having a chance to taste the beer. So it was like, it was total narrative and it was like, believe me. And I thought it was going to be all friends and family that knew me really well. And I actually got a lot of no's from that cohort. And you know, I wasn't like the pushiest person ever because people are funny about money. And I really just like kind of like kept talking to people. And a lot of my no's led to, you know, it's a no for me. I don't really do pre-revenue or the privates. But like, this person I know would probably be really excited to talk to you. Or like, this person might be really excited to talk to you. And it was really bleak for a while. I remember I went out to a college friend, organized a dinner with five of his friends. And I didn't have huge expectations for the dinner, but was like really thankful for the audience. I'd had like 40 no's at this point, which was like pretty exhausting. You like, you know, you travel an hour, you have a long conversation, you travel an hour home, and then you get a no like a week later. And like rinse and repeat 40 times was pretty tough.
Had you gotten any yeses at this point?
Yes. Some of my former colleagues and friends, basically it was like immediate yes, 100%. Here's 25 or 50 grand, which is like, I also didn't realize that like the size of angel checks is typically very small, even for super wealthy people, which was a miscalculation on my part too. I would have thought that like very wealthy people do like $250,000 angel checks. And I think that happens in some spheres of the economy, but not in like unproven pre-revenue manufacturing. So it was a lot more checks that I had to recalibrate, but yeah, back to that example of the dinner, like I'd had so many no's at that point that all five of them went in for $5,000 each. And I was like, so excited.
Yeah.
I ended up cobbling together an angel round with 70 investors, of which like me and my wife were the largest single investor and then like a very long tail. But that group of people, like a lot of people who had invested not much money in the angel round, I was writing monthly investor updates that were very accountable, saying exactly what we were doing. And every time, you know, we did a bridge round in October 2018, so 6 months on the market. And I was like, hey, investor team, essentially, like, I'm looking to raise a 500,000 bridge round strictly for working capital to scale. Like, we're starting to see some traction, as you've seen in the investor updates. And it was like, boom, immediately oversubscribed. And then our Series A, about 6 months later in March of 2019, I gave people a couple months notice and there were like good traction in the market. I was like, spring is gearing up pretty nicely. These are plans for the year ahead. I'm looking to raise this Series A. And it was like, boom, oversubscribed. And almost the same thing with our Series B a year later, which is a big step up. It was $17.5 million. And actually at that point, so all along the way, I had always thought I wanted to get institutional capital and funds that had seen other brands emerge from this stage and get going. And I really got a lot of no replies or no's outright, or people got fairly far into the process and then declined for any number of reasons. And I don't really blame them. We didn't have a great margin profile at that time. We had good unit economics, but like terrible EBITDA and like realized gross margins and stuff. And
yeah, but you were building breweries, right?
Yeah. And hiring a sales force and doing a lot of unscalable behavior. And it was always a no from the VCs, but I had this incredibly passionate angel cohort that was like very passive, let me run the ship. I was giving great updates every single month, which I think won me a lot of accountability. And so we got supported really well through our Series B by a group of angels and had no institutions along that way.
You mean even at the Series B or?
Yeah. So Series C was our first institutional round, which I think it gave us a lot of freedom to run the business really fast up to that point. And our Series C was led by Alliance Consumer Growth, who's like a great name in consumer VC. I'd actually been fortunate enough to meet their CFO at a farmer's market in the world a few years earlier. And she had joined my board of advisors. So I like knew them well by the time they got onto the cap table too. And I think that was the perfect time in our company's life cycle to get a real institution on the cap table who could help us with things like running proper board meetings and like what is a like proper monthly close and things like that look like. Not monthly close, but like monthly financial packet and like long-term planning, long-term organizational planning, like stuff like that. So mostly on like people and hierarchies and stuff like that. So it was like the perfect spot to go from this great groundswell of angel support to institutional investors at that point.
Was that 2020 or 2021?
2021 was our Series C.
Okay. And I think I saw $37 million in revenue that year.
Yeah.
That was definitely time. It's like, okay, this is a real business. There's like people really want this stuff. Should probably institutionalize it a bit.
Yeah, it was a good opportunity to get really focused. We have an incredible, well-rounded team. We brought in a couple more senior leadership team members too at that point. And it was the time to like team up with some people who really knew what the road ahead looked like as well. So in many ways, like just 100% still running the show. And like we have a very clear long-term vision and kind of like operating consistently towards that has been our thing.
So what is the long-term vision? We're talking 10, 20, 30, 100 years. I don't know how far out you plan and think, but what is it?
Yeah, it's basically beer for the modern adult. It's, you know, people have been drinking alcohol for 5,000 years and it's fine. But I just think there's going to be a majority of occasions in the future where people want to socialize, want to have something delicious, but not the alcohol. And we want to have a huge positive impact in the world on the way there too. But it's, so I in my head think that non-alcoholic beer is easily going to 10 or 20% of beer, if not 50% of beer over time, as increasingly influential people continue to talk about it publicly and destigmatize it and stuff. But I think this is just the very emergence of a long-term emerging category. If you look at like the emergence of the energy drink category, it was like from nothing. And Red Bull and Monster came out of nowhere and just like were really focused on it and grew it into this enormous category. What I think is different about non-alcoholic beer than all the other beverage alcohol trends is every other beverage alcohol trend has been like a one-for-one substitution of the same occasion. You know, if like someone's like drinking tequila this year, it's probably like they may have moved from like whiskey to tequila, but in the same occasion. What we're doing is like totally reinventing and opening up occasions. So it's more occasions for existing drinkers. Like, so take your average drinker who drinks one or less day per week. This permissions to people to drink 5 to 7 days a week and feel guilt-free about it and do it at a fraction of the calories and not slow them down at all. So like there's the occasion growth, but then there's the population growth too. In my age group, per Nielsen, 32% of adults don't consume alcohol. But as you go down the two generations after, 36% of the next generation don't drink alcohol. And the next one is 45% of Gen Z legal drinking age consumers don't consume alcohol. So like in two generations, 13%, change of the adult population drinking habits. So like, there's a big opportunity to welcome them into the adult beverage world. Plus, anyone who's lapsed from drinking alcohol for any reason at all, we can welcome them back into. So there's like a lot of growth there. And, you know, I, in my travels and readings, like one thing I heard Mark Andreessen say is like, you, if you could have like people, product, or category be right, you want category to be right more than anything. I think that's what we have here is like a really strong health and wellness and occasion growth category. And then we're trying to be the best product and the best marketed and the best distributed and the most focused in that category. And, you know, I'm just going to be here just like ruthlessly focused on it for like 25 years. And I think there are going to be a lot of people who come and go and stay focused on it for like 3 to 6 months. And like people within a big corporation might care about it for their like 2 year stint at the company. But like, we are just going to be here talking about non-alcoholic beer in 25 years still.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know if it's the internet's mature and the way people discover information has just changed, but I feel like we are definitely not going back to consuming unhealthy products. Like, I don't know the best way to tee up or to phrase what I'm trying to phrase, but we are only going to be probably making more informed decisions and trying, like, if I mean, you look at like what's the most popular podcast content influencers out there, like it's health stuff, wellness stuff, taking care of your things, you know, going around the incumbent solutions that have been created and pushed to us. So I feel like just this general trend of like being healthier, whatever that means, we're just going to keep going that direction.
Yeah, the number one most forwarded Apple podcast last year was Huberman on Alcohol, which so obviously hit an audience. And then, I mean, I know I'm like a walking prototype for our product and I've like built the product after myself, but like I have literally a Whoop and an iWatch. And if you like drink alcohol or get a bad night's sleep, they like wake up like blaring at you basically. It's like the first thing you see on the phone is like, Whoop, did you drink alcohol last night? You know, and there's just such more access to information. You know, when I was growing up, if you needed an answer to a question no one in the family knew off the top of their head, you'd like maybe think about the FDA food pyramid and encyclopedia. Like I'm not trying to like totally date myself. Like I did, we had dial-up modems and stuff, but like it's crazy how much information access has improved in like a 20-year period though.
Yeah, and then it's crazy the things that you're parents or grandparents, whatever, told you or knew was kind of the truth. What we know today, it's like, yeah, that was completely wrong. Like that was just some unfounded fact or stat. It was just pushed by who knows who or why. But yeah, like I feel like people, there's definitely some downsides to it though. I feel like there's some, you know, information that we maybe people are getting access to that might not be correct. There's definitely two sides to it, but on the health side, I feel like people are generally, they're able to inform themselves and make a little bit more of their own decisions, which generally I think is a good thing.
Yeah, for sure. And there's definitely bad health advice out there too. So
buyer beware or consumer beware. When you were figuring out how the heck do I market this thing, like back in 2018, 2019, they're kind of, maybe it wasn't as popular yet. Not quite as many people were thinking about this stuff or open to it. What did you do? Like, what was the strategy?
Yeah. So we've literally never done focus groups, never done like real surveys to try to get at things. Like we do measure and everything and we survey our existing customers for sure. But at that stage of the company, I was just thinking like myself, like where would I want to encounter this product and discover it? And it took some trial and error. Like I definitely tried sampling beer all over the place because I knew people would have to try it to believe it, that it was good, and imagine when it would fit into their life. And I really chose athletic events, not because of the name of the company, but because, you know, you could interact with hundreds of happy, sweaty, enthusiastic people in a very short amount of time and be very efficient with your time at athletic events. If I went to sample in like a liquor store or grocery store, I might interact with like 10 or 20 people per hour. Some of them are like there to buy a handle of vodka and are definitely going to make fun of me. And like, I spent so many nights in like liquor stores on Friday nights getting made fun of high school kids. It's unbelievable.
So the high school kids were making fun of you.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Oh, man.
So I like started to set up at like local 5Ks, half marathons, anything from like that distance all the way up to ultra marathons and Ironmans and triathlons and everything. And, you know, any given weekend, I'd be at least two races. We also had a tap room in Stratford, Connecticut. I opened as the bartender there. So, you know, I'd wake up at 3:30 a.m. on a Saturday. I'd drive wherever my race was that day. I'd pour hundreds of beers, get back to open the tap room, and then do something else on Sunday. But I was giving out thousands of beers a weekend on average. And like, you know, a lot of those people having pretty good experiences with it and then rushing into stores around that area. And like, I had really good data where like I would do a race in an area and then measure the rate of sale around those stores. It would be like, and so I knew I was onto something with that. And so, but it was like rolling up my sleeves and just getting out there and talking to people. And it cost almost nothing besides the cost of product and my time.
Yeah, I was going to say potentially when you talk about financial profile not being the best, just giving out all these free products, I could see how that could impact the gross margins a little bit, but it's marketing also.
For sure, yeah.
I mean, just generally, I think if you're, I don't know where the trade-off is, but I feel like as an early stage investor, you have to be comfortable with the financials not looking that pretty in a lot of cases, which is super hard. But I think my strategy for almost coping with that or getting comfortable with it is I usually try to not look at the actual financials too early on, because then you can kind of, it doesn't automatically turn you off. Like, oh, this company is like burning twice as much as they take in revenue. Like, I'm not interested at all. You can kind of get like the vision, the product, you understand their strategy. When you see the financials, you're like, okay, it does make sense. I understand why they're losing so much money, but you can kind of piece that together. The spreadsheet, you go a couple columns out, a couple years out, and maybe starts to look a little bit better.
Yeah, as long as there's like a real plan to change it and it's an agreed upon time where the company's going to change it and you're honest with your shareholders and your board about when that's happening. You know, in 2021, we were still unprofitable. We'd invested in a third facility. And 2022 was looking like a deeply unprofitable year too. But we had good unit economics. And I went to the board and I was like, this is our 4-year plan at this point. Wrapping up 21, 22 is going to be deeply unprofitable. 23 is going to be close. But like kind of wanted to like all hold hands as a board, as a management team and say, we are going to execute on this plan. If we deviate off this plan, this is where we're going to cut hard in 2022 on marketing and overhead and things to get closer to plan on EBITDA. But I was really thankful our board saw the timeline. All different classes of our investors were on board with that. But I appreciate that I had that leeway, but I don't necessarily think that works as well without a communicated plan. I think a lot of, you know, what I've seen, I have a lot of friends who are founders of all different types of companies, like outside of CPG too. And where I've seen trouble is where they don't communicate that plan far enough in advance, and then they get ambushed at a board meeting where it's like, you haven't changed fast enough and you're basically out, or we're cutting for you. And they're like, wait, but I've been meaning this. And it's like, you know, like you have to communicate that plan farther in advance. And like one of our great board members always said to me, like, I can take any amount of bad news, but I want my expectations set and communicated when there is bad news. And so I generally try to set long-term expectations.
Yeah, that's smart. The point about being able to take bad news, but just make sure it matches expectations or doesn't catch me too off guard. One of the, I think, super interesting pieces about your strategy is you did pretty heavily online, pretty quick, but it seems like you got into retailers relatively fast also. How did you manage that so early on?
It was kind of just an overall omni-channel strategy. It was like different teams working on different channels. And, you know, we had this unbelievable data set from our online business, and we're like learning a lot from that side of the business, and we had to provide the best customer experience we could. But we did kind of learn that it was almost like two different customer bases in a way. Also, like the customer base not only being the end buyer, like distributors and retailers have very different needs from like an online shopping customer too. And so distributors and retailers wanted efficient use of their square footage and like high velocity per square foot, basically. And we were kind of uniquely set to do that, where historically beer brands of alcohol do all their innovation testing on retail shelves. And so, you know, these big breweries launch like 40, 50 innovation products per year, and maybe five are back the next year. And so like they cycle through all this waste and unproductivity. With Athletic, we were doing all that testing on ourselves and then bringing the next season like a tried and proven lineup. And usually if we make any swaps, it's one of our products killing an existing product. And so that way, like with our distributors, with our retailers, it's very focused. Like what we're putting investment behind this quarter is going to be similar to next quarter and the next quarter. And a customer that we convinced to fall in love with, you know, Run Wild at a certain store in one quarter is going to be able to find that beer for years to come there. And I think that investment adds up over time. So, but yeah, retailers and distributors generally want simple. And then we kept all the noise off to the other platform.
So you kind of inversed what the general strategy is in food and beverage, in beverage specifically, is you did your testing online, and then your retail channels was like the proven, the hero products, the ones that you know are going to sell. So that when they're ordering, they know you maybe have a smaller percentage of shelf space, but even higher velocity and more sales. So you just look so good when they're looking at all their data. They're like, holy cow, we got to get more of this non-alcoholic athletic brewing stuff. We got to reorder faster.
Yeah. And it's simple too. So it's really efficient and profitable for them too. Yeah. I think a lot of brands don't have variety online too, because they use contract manufacturers and 3PLs. So to get like a complex lineup out to the D2C world can be tough sometimes. If at Athletic, we own and operate all the breweries. So in our breweries, we have everything from 3 and 7 barrel systems to 20 to 200 barrel brew houses. So like we can make anything from like, you know, 100 cases to thousands of cases at once. And that lets us be really nimble on what we make, what system we make it on and different things and where we make it. Plus, we do all of our fulfillment and packing in-house. So, you know, we pack and ship over 1,000 packages each day on both coasts. So they can be incredibly customized. We can do returns ourselves. We can do a lot of variety ourselves easily. So our owning all of our rails has really helped also.
Yeah, I was going to say that's also in terms of margins, a little bit more capital intensive, but once you get scale, probably better margins by just owning it all in-house.
Yeah. What's interesting about our breweries, you know, it's definitely better economics over time owning your manufacturing. Like scaling manufacturing, utilizing properly is definitely difficult. There's nothing worse for margins than an underutilized facility. And so we've definitely been through those valleys as well. An interesting thing too on the supply chain is if you own your facilities and make all your product, you can be more long-term forecasted and like hedge your inputs. Brands who contract brew tend to just be price takers. So it's like real-time commodity costs to the contract manufacturer. And like there's a big fluctuation of input of costs too. So like you may be fine in one season and not really thinking about it, but there are huge risks to contract manufacturing out there.
Interesting. The other thing I've heard with contract manufacturing too, if you are building the, you know, and it sounds like what you guys did, you kind of built up almost proprietary or a new way of doing something. But if you're using a contract manufacturer, it means that other people are also able to build their product the same way. So in terms of defensibility longer term, it's like, oh, I'm just going to use whoever contract manufacturer you are, and I'm going to make the same product. They're going to make it exactly the same way. And maybe I'll just undercut you on price or something. And then that just ruins your margins. So,
yeah. And contract manufacturers have shifting priorities too, where if like a brand who pays a majority of their bills or more bills than you do, like needs extra summer canning line capacity, like they will get it and you might get bumped and stuff. So
I heard your story of getting into Whole Foods. I know that was kind of how we started the conversation. How did that happen? I feel like there's, you know, I've heard the story is kind of interesting. Can you talk through that?
For sure, yeah. So me and John were hand bottling beer in his parents' garage, and it was unlabeled beer, like definitely not exciting packaging. And I went into local Whole Foods, and the local forager in the store, I was like, this is amazing. Basically, like, I presented with a plain brown bottle and was like, I'm really excited about this. Been working on this company for about a year, really 3 years, but like in business planning. But she tasted the beer and was like, this is amazing. Like, we've been waiting for this. I think you should go and talk to our buyers at Regional. And like, she's like, this is something we talk about. And I think our customers would really like it. And so like literally the next week I went to the Regional Whole Foods in New Jersey. And it was so cool to see for such a big company. Like, Whole Foods is not like, in many ways it still is your local natural grocery store. But for a big company, I was so shocked that like discovery could happen at the local level like that. And immediately they got something up the chain so fast to like a decision maker who can make a pretty big decision. And within like 2 weeks of meeting that first buyer, I basically had a commitment for Connecticut statewide whenever we launched. They obviously wanted to see like the branding and make sure it was compliant. But, and then since then, like, it started selling well there, and they've taken us to every state we've gone to and opened the stores immediately. So it's really cool to see a big company like that be so nimble.
Yeah, that is super impressive, especially when you think it's Amazon. It's like one of the biggest corporations in the world at this point.
And like, great, super accessible team at the store level. It's really like very decentralized. It's kind of the way we built the brand. Like, a lot of things these days, there's the temptation to like hyperscale and do things at like a touchless pace. And like, at Athletic, we've really kind of gone backwards and just like done the local thing, like met with key partners in person. When we have big news, we travel and we tell people. When we, you know, we sample our beer in person. We do a lot of, our team did over 55,000 store visits last year as a team. Like, we're literally in market talking to people all the time. And I think it's a Brian Chesky quote, but like, do the unscalable thing over and over again, which I'm sure I got wrong. But like, I always tell that to my team. It's like, sure, there's like all this you want to do, but if you just like start doing it and like, you know, if you do 10 unscalable things every day, at the end of the year, you've done thousands of unscalable things every day. And that's like pretty darn scalable at the end.
Yeah. Well, you were mentioning before that you have gone very slow, kind of compared to maybe what someone would expect. But I'm just looking at, you launched in 2018, and in 2023, I think you did like $90 million in revenue, or maybe that number's wrong, but that's pretty fast. 6 years to get $90 million in revenue, my opinion is that's pretty good. So you actually still did end up going pretty fast, even though you kind of went slow also.
We've added more dollars every year of revenue growth. Every year of growth has been better than the year prior. So it is kind of like a freight train. Once it's starting moving, like, it was really tough to get it going. And, but like, my big thing is just being like super consistent. And of course there are periods where we ship a bunch of meaningful work and stuff, but like, regardless, every day we're showing up and thinking about this and like doing more stuff. And I'm a big believer in being able to go like 65 miles an hour for a very long time. And it may not seem like the fastest time in the world. And I've had all sorts of times where investors or other industry participants or teammates have reached out to me with like real concern, being like, I don't think you're going fast enough on this. Why do you miss this opportunity? We should launch a canned water. Do you see what these guys are doing? Or like all sorts of stuff. And I'm like sitting here doing my thing, going 65 miles an hour every day. And like, there are people who go screaming by us, or like things we could have done. But like, at the end of the week, every week when you look back, it's like, wow, we made a bunch of progress. At the end of a month, it's like, wow, we made a lot of progress. And like, but I like look in our buildings now and our breweries, and it's all like literally thousands of small steps. And in like putting that to words, I think like, entrepreneurship is just such a long game. And as I said before, I have all the respect in the world for people who can hyperscale and do things and sell them really quickly. And but I think the really big outcomes happen over like much longer time scales. And it's just got to be like consistent effort and work and progress. And I think we are just that relentlessly consistent, compounding over a long time. And I'm so excited what this looks like in 10 years.
Yeah, you also said something super interesting in a different interview that I listened to. You said that most of the ideas, and it seems like new products and concepts, comes from the team. you just kind of let people run with ideas? Like, what did you mean by that?
I've always been a big believer in like decentralizing power as much as we can. You know, I kind of realized early on, there's this great book, The E-Myth Problem, which is basically the concept of like, if you want to do everything, like the company's not going to grow. Where an example for athletic early on is like, I thought I was like really good at the canning line and fast, which sounds so dumb at the time.
So this is like actually pouring the beers into the cans and bottling them and stuff?
Like doing the pack decks on top of the packs and stacking them in cardboard cases and putting them on pallets. And like, for sure, like maybe I was 10% faster than someone we would hire to do it. But our co-founder was like, you got to get out of the back and go like think about big term, big pictures, sell beer, work on finance. And where I'm going this is if a founder is like a single touch point that has to touch everything the company's done, it's like a very narrow funnel and nothing's going to ship quickly. No one's going to learn. No one's going to make mistakes. Innovation's not going to happen. Like the company can only be as good as I was in that instance. And I've been a big believer in giving people way more decision-making authority, more responsibility, like letting them grow into things, letting them be challenged, come at things with outsider perspectives, like people who've never been in our industry, just like jumped into the industry. But I think like through all our mistakes and through that decentralization has been so much more progress too. I have a general sense on like what's going on with everyone in the company. And we have like pretty good reporting structures on like a monthly and quarterly basis where you like get a bunch of material to read. And I try to catch up with people as regular as I can, but like there are a lot of people out there just running incredibly effective business units within Athletic Brewing who I totally trust also.
Yeah. I mean, you could not probably be doing $90 million in revenue if you were doing everything all by yourself. Like at some point, you got to figure out how to delegate.
Yeah. And I'm definitely like the master of none for sure.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if I could ever do it. Like I'm very bad at delegating. So that's why I just have a podcast and invest in startups because it's just not my skill set.
I'm definitely delusionally optimistic and like overly trust people to like run with it and learn. And, you know, when we see people make mistakes multiple times or not have that initiative and not be able to make progress, that's when we typically tend to move on. But like, you know, a lot of people have grown into it incredibly well too.
Awesome. Well, this has been a great conversation. Thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you so much. I feel like there's like, I could have done this for hours. So if I can be helpful to anyone in your audience, like please reach out. LinkedIn might be the easiest way. But yeah, I'm past the days where I've given out my cell phone number as the company number reluctantly. So, but yeah, thank you so much for having me on. I've loved following you on Twitter for years and your content. So really appreciate being a part of it.
Yeah, thanks for coming. This is a lot of fun. Thanks for listening to this conversation with Bill Schufelt, founder and CEO of Athletic Brewing. If you don't want to miss future episodes, subscribe to my newsletter in the show notes, and you'll get new episodes plus a transcript in your inbox. If you want to support the show, share this episode with a founder friend who's also trying to create their own market or category. Thanks again to Bill for coming on. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed. See you next time.